tonight on Arena. Wicked Housewife of the Year and The Piano Lesson are the movies up for review. And actor Mackenzie Crook on his love of the music of Nick Drake. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Tonight on our film reviews, Witches, Good and Bad, The Lovely Housewives Competition, and A Tale of Race and Memory from legendary American playwright August Wilson. So, the much anticipated film adaptation of Wicked lands in cinemas this weekend, buoyed up as it is by an all-star cast and the success of the stage show, which has been going on for 2 decades, believe it or not now. The odds adjacent films stars Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande pay Elphaba and Galinda, Witches in Training. Kieran Cassidy's new documentary, Housewife of the Year, brings us back to the competition made so popular in the 1980s by Gay Byrne, and in The Piano Lesson, our second stage to film adaptation of the Ealing brothers, Malcolm, who directs, and John David Washington, who stars, bring us August Wilson's tale of a family coming to terms with the past. These are two men who have to come to terms with their father's talent, he being Denzel Washington. Joined in studio this evening by Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington, and we'll start with Wicked, which gives us the origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West, the much maligned baddie from The Wizard of Oz. Maybe she's not so bad after all. Misunderstood, Ruth, I think, is kind of what Wicked tells us about the poor bad Wicked of the West.
And, you know, if you're born green, life is against you.
It's not easy being green.
It's not. Yeah. It's a sad old start to life. And you know,
Shrek and Kermit managed well enough.
Yeah, but it didn't go well for her, and it didn't go well for the family, in fact. Mm. So, she's born green, and she ends up the Wicked Witch. And the film starts, if you like, at the present of the end, at the end of the film, and
works its way back.
And then it works its way back in time.
When she's Elphaba, she's not the Wicked Witch of the West.
It starts at the end of The Wizard of Oz, basically, with the when she meets her terrible, and then it goes back to her very beginning. And it's actually, I had no interest in seeing this or any other musical, so I know some of the songs just because they're in the air. So I wasn't expecting very much of this.
And for once in my life, I'm hearing a butt coming that's going to turn into a big positive butt.
But it's a tremendous amount of fun. It's like an explosion in a chocolate factory. It's so colourful. But the two leads are brilliant. And it's 2 hours, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Didn't feel it at all.
I didn't get bored. I've got more bored in, you know, serious art films than I got in this.
And this is 2 hours and 40 minutes.
2 hours and 40 minutes. And I was thinking at the start, I was thinking, oh, this isn't going to work for me. But yeah, just like Paul, I was well entertained.
And how much of that is down to those two leads, as Paul has mentioned there, Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande?
Yeah, I thought Ariana Grande was a big surprise to me because, I mean, she's a singer, she's not an actor. Of course, obviously, she could do the singing, so that really helped. But she does a nice turn in sort of undermining her own. It's, you know, it's all about being pink, right?
Yeah.
This is Barbie Pink. And it's all about being pink and blonde and, you know, the most popular girl in class and being sort of alpha girl. But she does it with a wink to camera that's really, you know, it's funny.
Is she actually, when you say a wink to camera, does she actually look down the camera and speak to us as if it were an audience?
No, she doesn't. She draws attention to her own artifice. Yeah. It's a sort of flick of the hair that's
She's Galinda, we should explain. She's who becomes the good witch of the whatever.
The good witch of the East.
Apologies
to everybody in the west of the country.
In the world. But so she, when Elphaba's sister, who is in a wheelchair, goes
Lesser
to
Rose.
The University of is it Fizz?
To
the university, Elphaba's sent with her by the father, who doesn't like her for various reasons, to look after her, and she catches the eye of her talent becomes evident to Michelle Yeoh's character. But
Michelle Yeoh is one of the teachers there, is she?
She is. She's the professor of
Witchology.
Witchery or whatever.
Yeah.
And obviously Galinda's not best pleased by this because she fancied being a witch herself. Oh. And so they become sort of mortal enemies. They share a room, but then they come to an understanding.
They get to see each other. Let's have a listen to a clip. This is Ariana Grande. Possibly an Oscar bid here, is it? Galinda telling the somewhat gormless Elphaba how to win friends and influence people.
Popular, you're gonna be popular. I'll teach you the proper voice when you talk to boys. The ways to flirt and flaunt. I'll show you what shoes to wear, how to fix your hair. Everything that really counts to be popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohort. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, cause you've got an awfully long way to go. Don't be offended by my frank analysis. Think of it as personality dialysis. Now that I've chosen to become a power sister and advisor, there's nobody wiser. Not when it comes to popular. I know about popular. And with an assist from me to be who you'll be, instead of dreaming who you were, well, are. There's nothing that can stop you from becoming popular.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting you, Ariana. Or was that Cynthia at the very end? I'm not sure. Cynthia just going. Yeah. Oh, it was Ariana the whole way. It's impossible not to smile listening to that. Is that how the film gets you the whole way through?
Absolutely. It's very uplifting, and obviously it has its kind of sadness as well because of the suggestions of prejudice. People being judged on the basis of the colour and being different. But it's just it's joyous. The songs are good. It's very funny, and as we said, Ariana Grande reveals this unexpected talent for comedy. She has this sort of double hair flick that's straight out of the Miss Piggy handbook, and she can't pass a mirror without pausing to admire herself. And she says at one point, she says, "Something very strange just happened. I didn't get my way." So she's very funny.
And also you mentioned Michelle Yeoh. Jeff Goldblum as the Wizard of Oz. Who else could be the Wizard of Oz?
He's hamming it up. And then there's also the
That's unusual, is it?
There's the very gorgeous boyfriend who turns
Yes, I was going to ask
you
about him. Lord Anthony Bridgerton.
That's right.
Has lived on. This is Jonathan Bailed, isn't it?
Yeah. He's very good as well.
Yeah, he's very, very good. Very entertaining. Again, he's really, he's hamming it up. And the camera makes him look absolutely desirable and handsome, and of course, Ariana Grande's character in The Wicked Witch of the East, she just says, "Well, he's going to marry me." He doesn't know, but he's going to marry me, and that's it. But then,
things may not turn out the way she thinks.
Could be a bit of competition.
Yeah, the sort of soul in the film comes from Cynthia Erivo and her character, and in fact, the camera. She's really good on it, and the makeup is brilliant. She looks very beautiful as the green person, and the camera is in her face a lot, and she is the one who has to do the most emoting without talking.
It is quite an emotional role.
It's a very emotional, a tear in the eye at times, Sean. It's a very emotional role because she has been misunderstood and is about to be tragically misunderstood, as we know. It won't go well for her. Yeah. So that adds a kind of heft to it.
However, it is 2 hours and 40 minutes. Now both of you have said you didn't.
And it's only
feel
part one as well.
This is part one. Are you kind of waiting for part two with bated breath? Are you kind of looking forward to it?
I probably need the emotion to kind of settle a bit before I go for part two. I don't think I'm just
ready.
Too much. Yeah, I just need to.
If it's of this standard, it'll be great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm detecting a little note of irony in that, but I get.
No! It was really well entertained. Well entertained.
Okay, well, stars then for Wicked.
I gave it 4.
Four.
Same for me, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Really enjoyed it.
Well, I suppose things don't run as stage musicals for 2 decades
without doing something right. They have to be doing
something right, and clearly the film version has picked up on that. That might well be a big one for the Christmas. Has it Oscar? Is there Oscar buzz around this?
You never know, because I think there might be, because they do take, traditionally they haven't taken musicals seriously or musical roles seriously, but in a year that might be a little bit leaner than usual. You never know.
I think a Cynthia Erivo would be well up for an Oscar, certainly.
Mm. Yeah. Right. Well, we will watch with interest on that one. Now, I don't know if that is, if the period, whatever period it's set in, Wicked is a simple time, but we're certainly going to go back to a much more simple time or a simpler time in Ireland for our next film. When Gabe was on the telly, wifeliness was a competitive pursuit as much as it was a life choice to aspire to. Housewife of the Year is the title of this documentary from filmmaker Ciarán Cassidy. It reflects on the competition of the same name with some of the women who took part back in the 1980s and reveals the truth of their lives outside the competition. It's very easy in 2024 to look back and poo-poo on this competition.
But that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah, probably. I was hoping we might get a little bit less cynicism before you did all of that. Ruth.
not running, not in the competition.
Yeah, we're gonna, what are your thoughts on the original competition and what it asked for? It was really wifeliness in a very traditional sense.
But, you know, here's the thing, Sean. This ran between 1969 and 1995.
Like, yeah.
1995 isn't, you know, it's not the dark past of our history. 1995 is not that long ago.
But it's funny, the producer Sinead was talking to me tonight about small things like these, which is the kind of the same period.
Yeah, that's
so,
true.
You know,
yeah.
we're inclined to forget that the
80s and 90s. It's not the 1950s.
Yeah, it's not, even though sometimes it feels like it when you're looking back.
Yeah, it does. It feels like what we think the 1950s were, and forget that actually the 1950s ran up for a very, very long time. Yeah, so it ran between 69 and 95. And women from all over the country competed to be Housewife of the Year. And to be Housewife of the Year, you had to be...
good at the cooking.
Great at the cooking, great around the cooker. And of course, if you won, you got a new cooker because it
later
on was sponsored. It was the Calico's.
They used to be big rivals and then became, you know, teammates, as it were.
Yeah, and you got, and of course, actually for some of the women, you got a cheque for £300. And for some of the women, that was a game changer.
Hmm. You know, well, certainly, we were looking at it somewhere in the region, in today's money, about 1,000, which I suppose if you were coming from a situation where you had very, and the 80s, lots of people had less than nothing.
And big families.
And these huge families. I mean, some, I thought it was great. But and what they did was they singled out some of the women and they interviewed them. But the really good thing was they had interviewed them for the programme. So they had great archive footage of the women as they were
back then,
in the family
then,
home with the many children and the cooking and turning out all these cakes. And then they have them step onto the stage with their backs to the camera. And they then talk about how they feel about that time then.
And they look back now,
And they look back at it. And some of them look back with, you know, great sense of achievement in what they've done. Some of them look back kind of horror. And some of them reveal what they couldn't reveal at the time about their family life.
Yes.
Let's have a listen to a montage of the televised Housewife of the Year, which will give you a real sense of what the competition was back then. And of course, within all of this, you'll certainly recognise the broadcaster's voice.
Ladies and gentlemen, your compere for this evening, Gabe Byrne.
Welcome in Teddyland to the final of the Housewives of the Year.
I always think of it as a time when you're a full-time housewife, mother of five children, and this is kind of like a day out of that.
I told you we met some fascinating and attractive and lovely and talented women around this country this year.
You look back and you think, how did we just accept the way it was? Why did we do that? Why did we just go along with all these things?
Little montage there from Housewife of the Year. And it's interesting what you hear there. You hear that obviously Gabe Byrne back in the day in the actual televised competition. And then you hear one of the women, don't know which of them particularly it is there, who's kind of beginning to ask the questions, what were we actually doing?
Yeah, yeah. I had actually never heard of it. I don't know how, but I'd never heard of it.
Innocence of youth, Paul.
Well, yeah, and when it was on the telly, I would have been away by the time, even at the end of it. But it's phenomenal. And the whole tone of it, and...
you can see where Father Ted got the idea.
Well, and
Lovely Girls competition,
said that, the Lovely Girls. Gay at one point says, lovely women, you know, which, as you do. But there's a couple of things. There's one, Gay is talking about the whole attitude to... huge families and how it was just how it was and wonderful. And you wonder why children were so undervalued in this country. But he says at one point that this woman, and she has, can't remember how, she, some of them, they can't remember their names, they've got so many children. Mm. And Gay says to one of them, is that the end of it now? And she says, hopefully, Gay. And he says, would you go again? And the audience start cheering. It's another planet.
I don't know if that was Anne McStay, because there are a couple of stories.
It wasn't Anne McStay. She was
amazing.
Her story. Tell us a bit of her story, Ruth.
So she was married at 20. By the time she was 31, she had 13 children.
Prone to twins, wasn't she?
Yeah. Four sets of twins in that lot. And each time there was another baby, her husband spent longer in the pub. And so he just vanished off to the pub. That was his way of coping with his big family. Mm. And they were absolutely destitute. So she was forced to go to what we'd now call a food bank. And she gets this big pot of steaming stew from the food bank. But she has to travel back on the top of a double-decker bus with this big pot of steam.
Yeah,
and everybody knew where she'd just been. Yeah. But then, you know, there's some great redemption, kind of stories of redemption in this. Because later on, she pops up on the Late Late Show giving out to the priest on the Late
She
Late
became
show.
An activist, yeah. And she just at the Times, there's this Vincentian priest lecturing her about birth control. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's where we were.
And she turns, she turns around, and like the strength to come from to come from that, and to you know,
turn around and say,
to turn your life around like that.
What Kieran Cassidy has done here, the director, this idea of actually. He had so much footage from obviously the original competitions to go on, which must have been an absolute joy, but a lot of it had to be watched and waded through. But then to get them to do the almost the equivalent type of competition
and walk out onto the stage and everything, yeah.
It's a very clever way of showing us how things have changed in the intervening 40, 50 years. Can you look back at it with any kind of, with anything other than annoyance or anger?
Horror. I just find it horrific. And I think one of the things, and this is completely, you know, of its time, but just you kind of relook at Gay Byrne, you know, and he stands up on stage and he's egging them on. And he, you know, he was the voice. He was somebody that was so popular with the Irish housewife, if you can
use
that word.
But he was representing the Ireland of his time, wasn't
he? Yeah, very much what had been said by anybody.
But he holds their hand. You know, they're often very anxious for good reason because they have to perform.
Yeah.
And you know, a song or tell a story, whatever it is, and so he holds their hand very nicely. But it comes over now as so deeply
patronizing. You wouldn't do it now.
Yeah. You wouldn't.
Well, it was different, I suppose. Yeah,
it's a different time. I'm not suggesting anything.
It was basically a manifestation of the patriarchy. Like you know, this is what's expected of you, and nothing more. And plopping out children.
Stars from you on this one, Paul.
Again, four. I think it was fascinating documentary and it's well put together as well.
I gave it five. I was really sold on it. I thought, you know, we've had a lot of documentaries about Ireland's past, but this one worked.
Yeah, it's kind of a social history as much as anything else. Finally, then, The Piano Lesson. Kieran Cassidy, as I said, the director there. The Piano Lesson, Malcolm Washington's adaptation of August Wilson's play, which stars his brother John David Washington, both of them, as I said, sons of Denzel, lands on Netflix tomorrow after a short cinema release. It's about a black American family in the 1930s dealing with the psychic remnants of slavery as an opportunity for advancement arising. Fascinating how this is done through a piano, Ruth.
Yes, and so The Piano Lesson is a misleading title to some extent because it's a lesson about a piano. It's not about taking piano lessons.
And it's not used much, the piano, sure. It's not.
It's this family, it's set at family play. It's, as you said in your introduction earlier on, it's August Wilson's from this cycle of plays, and he wrote one every 10 years about this family. Most of them are set in Pittsburgh, and it's really charting the black experience from slavery up to present day urban black lives. So this film, it looks back at this family. They've moved up from the south, and they're now living in Pittsburgh, and they've taken with them this piano, and so the central character is the mother of the family, Bernice, and she's played by Danielle Deadwyler, who is just stunning in it. And so she's got the piano in the house in Pittsburgh. It's actually not her house, it's her uncle's house, and it's Uncle Doker, played by Samuel L. Jackson. But her brother comes up from the south, and he wants to sell the piano in order to buy back land. And to set himself up as a farmer, which he couldn't have done in the past.
All right, let's have a listen to, I think this is Danielle Deadwyler, explaining why this piano is so important. She's looking back at her ancestors.
Mama Ola polished this piano with her tears for 17 years. For 17 years, she rubbed on it till her hands bled. Then she rubbed the blood in, mixed it with the rest of the blood on it. Every day, God breathed life into her body. She rubbed and cleaned and polished and prayed over. Play something for Bernice. Play something for me, Bernice. Play something for me, Bernice. Every day. I cleaned it up for you. Play something for me, Bernice. You always talking about your daddy, but you'll never stop to look at what his foolishness cost your mama. 17 years worth of cold nights in an empty bed for what? For a piano? For a piece of wood? To get even with somebody?
Yeah, there we have Danielle Deadwilder there in the scene from the piano lesson. And it's the lesson is teaching, the piano is teaching a history lesson is really what's going on. It's an extraordinary cast. Danielle Deadwilder, obviously hugely important within the
call. It is a great cast. Actually, Samuel L. Jackson, who can tend to play sort of showy roles, is actually really good as the uncle in it. And John David Washington, who doesn't look like his father at all, but he's starting to sound like him a lot in his intonations and everything.
Do worse than sound like Denzel Washington do a lot worse. Now.
But the interesting, the two attitudes to the piano, her attitude, like it like for her, like it or not, it's the blood of her family. It's an heirloom, and it tells their story, emerging from slavery. Whereas for Boy Willie, it's a detestable thing because it tells their story of having emerged from slavery.
It was originally a play here, and we hear that. I mean, that's a 52-second clip, which is purely a speech and probably a section within a longer speech. It is quite speechy in places. Does it shed its stage origins, Ruth?
This was the only kind of the only place where I would have faulted it, which is that it's almost like two films. So there's the film of the stage play, and then the bits where he intersperses the staginess with very cinematic moments, such as the haunting at the end.
And the singing.
There's a great call and response.
And the opening sequence where there's a fire and they were robbing the piano. This is 25 years before the action.
Yeah, you don't really know what's happening in that opening, but it gets explained.
It's full of action.
Full of action. To me, it was still a little bit overly stagey. And the two didn't meld totally, the action sequences and the staginess.
Yeah. I think it's the I think that Denzel Washington has done people a service by bringing this and the other plays, Fences and... Mara Rennie's Black Bottom and the other one to
the screen.
But the price you pay, they don't want to touch the plays, which are so important. Yeah. And this is the price you pay, but they're still worth watching.
Start?
3.5.
3.5 from you, Paul. What are you saying, Ruth?
Yeah, 3.5.
3.5 as well, Ruth.
But I'd urge people to watch it.
Yeah. And the others, as you said, it is a long history that's been told across a series of plays. The Piano Lesson will land on Netflix from tomorrow, so you can watch it in the comfort of home if you so wish. Shouldn't be saying that. The cinema owners would kill me. Housewife of the Year will be in selected cinemas. And Wicked goes on general release tomorrow, thanks to Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. It's 50 years this month since English folk singer-songwriter Nick Drake died at the age of just 26. In his short life, he recorded three albums, Five Leaves Left in 1969, Brighter Later in 1971, and Pink Moon in 1972. And while he may not have enjoyed widespread success during his lifetime, generations that followed have discovered and celebrated his music. In a quirky little book just published, actor, director and writer Mackenzie Crook has imagined an afternoon spent with his hero, Nick Drake. It's called, the book that is, If Nick Drake Came to My House. It's written and illustrated by the multi-talented Mackenzie Crook, best known to us, I think, as Geeky Gareth in the BBC comedy The Office, as Rigetti in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and more recently as Andy in the BBC series Detectorists, which he created, wrote and directed. So he truly is multi-talented, and delighted to have him on Arena with us this evening. Good to have you here, Mackenzie.
Thanks, Sean. Nice to be here.
When did this kind of wish that Nick Drake might come around and have a chat with you at home? When did your love of his music kind of start to kick in?
I think I first listened to his music in the late 90s, but that was after years of it being recommended to me by various friends and acquaintances. And for some reason, I put it off for years before I finally got around to it. And I think it was something to do with, you know, when people are so insistent that you have to listen to this or you have to watch this film, and you sort of, I don't know, it seems too worthy. You sort of put it aside. It feels like homework or something, and the pressure is on you. And so, yeah, I resisted for years until finally I was forced into a corner, forced to listen to this music. And of course, I instantly fell in love with it and regretted those years that I'd missed.
Yeah, it's often a fear too, apart from the, you know, when you're told go and eat your broccoli, or it feels like you're being told to go and eat your broccoli, you know, one isn't kind to resist that. But there's also that fear that when you're told something so amazing that you put it on, you'll start to listen and go, yeah, it's good, but it's not. So why is everybody jumping up and down about it? Your jumping up and down started immediately. And I think as a contrarian, you started by listening to Pink Moon, the third of the three albums.
Yes, yeah, for some reason, that's the one that I connected with, that stripped back quality. It's just him and his guitar. And I think I probably flattered myself that I was going to be able to learn these songs on my guitar because I was trying to learn at the time. And I soon realised that that wasn't going to be the case because he's such a skilled guitarist. He makes it seem simple, but the tunings that he uses and his finger picking is so advanced that I had to give up that idea quite soon.
How good a guitarist were you at that time? Were you middling good?
You see, the thing is, I tried for years to learn the guitar. I always reached this ceiling through which I couldn't break. And I could learn things parrot fashion, but I didn't really understand what I was doing. I don't understand the alchemy of music making. It's magic to me. And so, yeah, I've never been a good guitarist. And in fact, when my son got better than me a few years ago, I put my guitar aside quite happily and decided to leave that to him.
In fact, your son Jude, isn't it? Is he in his 20s now, in and around that age?
Yes, he's nearly 22. And it's in fact him that I featured in the book, in the illustrations. It's him that opens the door to Nick Drake.
Ah, right. And that's a lovely kind of, there's a kind of a family symmetry in that in some ways, because the fact that it is If Nick Drake Came to My House is the title of the book. It harks back to a book that, in fact, you as a child, and I think it was your father who received it, that you as a child read and were interested in. Remind us of that book.
Yes, this was a book that my father got in, I think, 1946 when he was 5 years old. And it's a Sunday school book. It's by Joan Gale Thomas, and it's called If Jesus Came to My House. And it imagines a little boy opening his front door to find Jesus also as a little boy has come round to spend the day. And they just spend a few quality hours playing and talking. And, yeah, that idea always bewitched me. I always used to ask to see this book. And it was a couple of years ago that, yeah, the idea sprung to me that I should do an homage to this book, a tribute to it and to Nick Drake, and change it to If Nick Drake Came to My House. So it's very much in the style of that 1940s book with very simple illustrations.
And the illustrations, simple they may be, but a bit like the simple guitar playing that you spoke about in the case of Nick Drake, making illustrations simple isn't always as easy as it looks either. That was a big love of yours, in fact, a hoped for career at one stage, I think, was it, to be an artist?
Yes, I've always drawn, and you know, at school when you're told you're really good at drawing, you know, you're that sort of currency when you're at school to be the best drawer in the class. I always imagined that that's what I would do, but then when it came to getting into art school, I didn't manage it, and I had to rethink. Which, in hindsight, you know, I'm happy about. I'm happy the way my career has gone, but yeah, I always thought that's what I was going
to
do.
Yeah, you've done okay, it has to be said, in the meantime. You were talking about your son, Jude, that he that is illustrated in the book as the guy who opens the door. I think he's a big fan of Nick Drake's as well.
Yes, and that was very deliberate on my part. I used to do, when he was first born, I used to do the 3 o'clock in the morning feed, and I would always play Nick Drake to him as a sort of deliberate way of sort of trying to infuse his music into by some sort of osmosis, that it would seep in and he would become a musician and a Nick Drake fan. And both those things have happened, and I couldn't be happier.
So way back before it was fashionable, you were manifesting to your infant son.
Exactly, yes.
there is the music of Nick Drake speaking to your 22-year-old son and speaking to you and speaking to generations, as I've said, who have heard his music since his untimely death.
What do you think it is about Nick Drake and his music that resonates so much with people?
I mean, you know, the quality of the music is unquestionable. It's beautiful. There's not very much of it. It's not like you have to trawl through a massive back catalogue to find the bits that you like. You know, there's these three perfect albums that can be listened to comfortably in an afternoon. And also just the story of him is so alluring and poignant. You know, that he didn't get to enjoy the success in his lifetime, but since so many people have found it and so many artists cite him as an influence, the whole thing is a beautiful story.
Yeah, and you know, when I heard about this book and I started thinking about you and your work, I thought, jeepers, it makes even more sense now of the theme tune for Detectorists, which isn't that far off a Nick Drake sound.
Yes, well, you know, as I said, I don't understand how music is made, so I like to associate myself with and align myself with great musicians. So when it came to, I was listening to Johnny Flynn's music while I was writing Detectorist, and I went to him and asked if he would compose the soundtrack, which he happily did, and that became as much of a character in the show, I think, as the human characters. And then also with Wurzel Gummidge, I approached the Unthanks, and they composed the soundtrack for that. So yes, I'm a big music fan, even though I can't create it myself.
Yeah, and in fact, the Unthanks are going to be on with us next week on the programme. I'll be telling them how big a fan you are, but should they already know that because of Wurzel Gummidge? I'm guessing Andy Stone, the character in Detectorists, he probably would be a Nick Drake fan, would he?
I think I've got a feeling we mentioned him at one point in the show. Yeah, I mean, and he's a folk. I mean, Andy's kind of just a version of myself, really, a slightly more pathetic version of me.
So we would find you with a metal detector going around parts of England looking for stuff, would we?
I'm afraid you would. Yes, not very often. Three or four times a year I go out, but yeah, it has become a hobby of mine. It wasn't beforehand, but it is now.
And I guess, I mean, there's quite a large kind of country aspect and rural aspect to Detectorists in that regard. That love of the country goes back, and the love of the countryside goes back quite a long way, I think, as well.
Yes, I mean, the natural world is a big passion of mine. And in fact, that's another area I could have gone into. I did lots of conservation work when I was younger. I was brought up in suburbia, but always just a short hop to the countryside. And yeah, British wildlife is a big interest and passion of mine.
Gareth in the office, would he have listened to Nick Drake, or would he just have dismissed it?
I think, yeah, I'm happy to say he would have dismissed it. It's not his sort of thing at all.
You had a wonderful gig recently, which involved Gabrielle Drake and some of the family and others who were associated with Nick Drake when he was alive. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was at the South Bank Centre a couple of weeks back, and it was a panel in front of a live audience, and it was Richard Morton Jax, who has recently written a beautiful biography of Nick Drake. Mm. His sister, Gabrielle Drake, Joe Boyd, his producer, and Brian Wells, one of his best friends. And yeah, I mean, I guess I was there just representing the fans of his music, but I felt a little bit like an intruder. I didn't quite understand why I was there, but it was amazing to share the stage with three people that knew and loved him back in the day, yeah.
And had they seen the book? Did you share the book with them on the evening?
Yes, I think they'd been warned about it. I was nervous about what Gabrielle might think of it, because she protects his legacy and his music so closely. But she was absolutely charming, and she loved the book, and she pointed out a couple of the illustrations which she thought that I'd captured some sort of essence of Nick in those pictures. So I was over the moon to hear that.
Yeah, hugely gratifying, I would have thought. And given, as we said, it had its origins in the title, certainly, and the idea it's written in verse, in, you know, kind of quite straightforward poetic verse, the same as the Joan Gill Thomas book, If Jesus Came to My House. Do you think there's a spiritual aspect to the whole Nick Drake experience, in the same way as obviously a mention of Jesus has a religious aspect to it?
Yes, I think there is. I can't quite put my finger on it, but, you know, when I have told people about this book, a few people have said, oh, why Nick Drake? As if I had a whole list of people it could have been. But that was not the case. It was only ever Nick Drake turning up at my house. And I, you know, I've illustrated him in the book with a halo around his head. I don't know, it's something about his story, something about the gentleness of his music and the idea that, you know, you would like to spend some quality time. And yeah, there is a spiritual aspect, certainly.
I also wondered whether this is the beginning of a series, because I think you could have, if Oscar Wilde came to my house, or certainly if I met Oscar Wilde at a post box not too far from my house.
Yes, I mean, I think it probably all stems from this book, that the If Jesus Came to My House. But I've always had conversations, imaginary conversations with my heroes that I could never get to meet through time or circumstance or whatever. But yes, as you say, there's a post box just around the corner from my house in North London, which was used apparently by Oscar Wilde at the end of the 19th century. And so I will always go out of my way to post my letters in that box and stop and have a quick conversation with Oscar.
What kind of things, not so much to see, do you say to him? What does he say to you?
Well, it's more often Charles Dickens that I walk around London with. I sound like a madman, but I'm a big fan of Charles Dickens and his writing about London. So if I'm walking around London, we will point out different areas that have changed a lot in both of our times.
Yeah, I was wondering how the Barbara Kingsolver book, I don't know if you've read it or not, Demon Copperhead, which is a kind of a modernised version, if you like, of David Copperfield. But she went to the Dickens house and more or less felt that Dickens's ghost said, get on with it, write this book, Barbara. You're a big fan of his. Would David Copperfield be high on the list?
Yeah, quite possibly. It's one of my favourite Dickens novels, that and Great Expectations. Yeah, so I don't know, maybe there is a series in it.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about that ghostly aspect of things. How ghostly a presence was Nick Drake when you were not only writing the words of this, but I'm guessing the illustration might have more of it's a slower process, I'm presuming, and therefore might have had a chance for him to come and tap on your shoulder and speak to you in some way.
Yes, well, you know, I was listening to his music as I was drawing those pictures, and it was a very meditative process. I never felt a presence, but yeah.
You had the music in the background, you didn't need the presence. Maybe you'd finish up, if you would, Mackenzie, by choosing a Nick Drake song that's one that you think people don't know his work. Here's a good way to start.
Yeah, well, I've been surprised. I thought I was the last person to find Nick Drake's music. But since talking about this book to people, I've found a lot of people, you know, even close friends of mine, that have never even come across his music before. So I quite often recommend Riverman as a gateway in. It's such a beautiful song that grabbed me immediately.
What particular aspects of Riverman had struck you?
Both music and lyrics. Quite most of the music that I listen to, the lyrics are a very important part to me. They're beautiful and not obvious what it's about. You can, you know, put your own interpretation on them. But it really is poetry set to music.
Mackenzie, lovely to speak with you today, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
So that's Mackenzie Crook. If Nick Drake Came to My House is the name of the book that Mackenzie has written and illustrated. It's published by Ebury Press, available right now. And we'll finish up with Mackenzie's choice of song, Riverman.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. Said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose a way to lose, but she believes. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I. If he tells me all he knows, but
about the way his river flows and all night shows in summertime.
And that is Riverman, the choice of Mackenzie Crook, the Nick Drake song. And Mackenzie's book is called If Nick Drake Came to My House, and it is published by Ebury Press. Jonathan Dove has been celebrated for his operatic works that bring timeless stories to life with modern resonances. His operas including Flight, which we spoke to him about last year, in fact, The Adventures of Pinocchio and Tobias and the Angel have been performed worldwide. The work frequently highlights deep concern for social and environmental issues, bringing these themes to the stage in new ways. In his opera, The Walk from the Garden, Dove takes on one of the most pressing challenges of our time, climate change. Here he reimagines the biblical story of Adam and Eve to reflect humanity's fraught relationship with the natural world and the uncertain future that lies ahead. Delighted to be joined once again on Arena this evening by Jonathan Dove. I mentioned the dreaded words climate change at the beginning of that, Jonathan, and you have stated that that is often something that is a turnoff for people. Why do you think that it is? I mean, it's a huge issue and we can't ignore it. Why do you think it causes people to kind of go, oh, do I need to listen to this?
I know it's something we haven't dealt with at all, and yet we're already exhausted with it. It's big and it's frightening, and it seems unmanageable, and it's very understandable to want to bury your head in the sand, I think, and or to look the other way. But I think that also... well, a reason for writing the opera and trying to talk about it in an opera is to create a space where you can contemplate aspects of what's happening, and so to deal with this unmanageable thing in a manageable scale, thinking about it and on a very human scale. I'd never think that an opera is going to save the world, but I think, as I say, I think it can offer a space where you can resonate with something.
And I think there were two things at play. Obviously, the Adam and Eve story is hugely important here. That's the kind of the vehicle that you're using. But it was specifically a trip to the Arctic, I think, is it as far back as 2008, that really woke your mind up to what you needed to do and say, or what you felt you could do and say here.
Yes, absolutely. I think of that as my climate awakening. It was an extraordinary voyage where I was taken on a boat with a group of scientists and a group of musicians. And the musicians and a few other artists were there to learn about climate change, to what was happening. And the scientists were really there to explain what we were seeing. And when you actually look out at the Arctic, you just think, but this is a place of extraordinary beauty and landscapes such as I've never seen. But our Inuit guides could tell us, well, yes, but actually 10 years ago, this would all be ice and we could catch our seals with our sledge. And now we can't. And you realize things are changing. They're changing slowly so that it's possible to not notice for a while. And so with that, that was this a kind of education for me. And I read things, but I hadn't really taken on board the scale and the urgency of climate change. And I thought, well, being given this extraordinary experience, I wanted to repay that in some way. And I have to write about it. You know, this is the most interesting thing that's happening right now. There has to be a way of writing about it, but. How do you do that in an opera? And you think about, when you think about climate change, you often think about, you know, very, very large scale things, you know, floods and the water levels and the icebergs. And so an opera is about human beings. So it took me a long time to find a way of framing a story that you could simply sing. But Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden, or in fact being expelled from the Garden of Eden, came to seem a very resonant story. And it was particularly, I was invited to write something for a sacred space, for the cathedral, in fact. It was Salisbury Cathedral. And so it made sense to be telling a biblical story. And so the opera begins with the banishing, with Adam and Eve being flung out of the Garden of Eden, or, you know, expelled.
Yes.
And really the whole length of it is them taking that in.
And that opening section is quite, I suppose, if I could use the term, operatic in how it is expressed musically, in that we have the voice of God, we have a chorus here presenting that for us, and we have, you know, quite a large sound initially. But what really interests me is you talk about it, it's about people, and you get into the intimate story of Adam and Eve, where we're left with just the two voices, a soprano and a tenor, I think it is, that you have singing here, with string quartet. This is something that you did a kind of similar thing with in a piece of yours called In Damascus.
Yes, I found that the string quartet is a wonderful accompaniment for the voice, because it's very intimate, it's just four instruments, and yet it has such a range that is kind of like a miniature orchestra. So it's very, very rich. But it never drowns the voices. So I thought this would be a lovely way to accompany just these two voices through the opera. And In Damascus was written shortly after The Walk from the Garden. And I guess I was still discovering different ways of using the string quartet with the voice.
And we're playing, well, I want to play a piece of In Damascus, because there is no recording of A Walk from the Garden just yet. But this gives us a sense, I guess, of the kind of textures that you explore, particularly in the body of this opera, Walk from the Garden. But it is, as I say, the piece is In Damascus. Have just a section from In Damascus, a composition by Jonathan Dove, which features string quartet. And I believe that was the voice of Mark Padmore we were listening to there, Jonathan, in that particular performance with the Zacconi Quartet. At least that's the
That's record. Right. Yes, I wrote it for him and for the Zacconi Quartet,
And interestingly, that particular piece had a kind of a political aspect to it, but you explored it in much, I think, in the same way as you've done in this opera, in a kind of an allegorical way, rather than it's about Syria. You wanted to write something about Syria, but it's not kind of on-the-nose politics. You come at it from the side, I think.
Yes, it's a very sort of, if you like, tactful piece of writing. The words, which are, you know, by a Syrian poet who was living in Damascus in 2011 and had lived there and became an exile. But the way he wrote about it, it was not about the most dramatic things, about the most visually striking aspects. It was quite sort of private experiences. And startling ones, and that piece we just heard, talking about things that seem like normal life, and you realize that even though terrible things are happening, life is still going on somehow. And because of that, the sort of discretion of the words, it made it possible to sing them. I couldn't have sung or imagined somebody writing music for somebody to sing if it had been all about bombs, and it would have been It would have been an intrusion of mine, I think.
And to bring it back to a walk from the garden, in the same way, there would be very little point in somebody standing up on stage and singing us loads of scientific facts about the awful things that will happen if we don't change. So you give us this kind of intimate version of Adam and Eve, a soprano and a tenor voice, I think it is, that you're using here again, with string quartet, for the body of the opera itself. Were they easy characters to get to know, Adam and Eve?
Well, they've got obviously this predicament right in front of them. They've never been anywhere else except the Garden of Eden, and they now realise that they're about to lose it. And so there's a nostalgia is probably not a strong enough word, but you know, just thinking about all the wonderful experiences they've had and that they're about to lose, and also thinking then about the creatures that they want to remember. And Alastair Middleton, who wrote the libretto, very elegantly, he's not, because of course you know that we're living through the sixth mass extinction. But in fact, in the opera, we don't talk about recent or current creatures that are currently endangered. He refers to the phoenix and the unicorn, the simurgh, and the basilisk. So we sort of stay in this kind of mythical place.
But the intention quite definitely is to just make us think a little bit about how those myths could become a reality in the contemporary world. I guess that's the major point, Jonathan.
Well, it's also to express the loss that we are already feeling.
Yeah.
And when we think about it, there's a grief about what we know we are losing now and what we stand to lose in the future. And I think music gives a place where you can express that grief.
Absolutely. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us this evening, and really looking forward to hearing eventually a recording of A Walk from the Garden. But you will be able to see and hear it at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Armagh on November the 28th, at St. Coleman's College in Newry on November the 30th, and at St. Joseph's Redemptorist Church in Dundalk on December the 1st. Full details on operacollectiveireland.com. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy researched, Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator, Harry Booklis was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night at 7. John Creedon will be with you after the news.